Our parsha is Parshat Behar. And our parsha is bringing us to the conclusion of the book of Vayikra. The book of Vayikra, as we discussed previously, took a break and focused on the laws of Kohanim and sacrifices and laws of holiness and purity and defilement. And basically, Behar and Bechukosai bring us to the conclusion. So what are the concluding points? In Behar, we will learn all about the laws of Shemitah, the laws of Yovel, and the laws of certain dedications that a person can make with his land and his assets to the temple. And Bechukosai, as we will learn Be'ezrat Hashem next week, teaches us about the warnings. What happens if we don't keep the Torah? Traditionally, we always read Bechukosai 2 weeks before Shavuos. So, Behar and Bechukosai are connected or divided depending on how Pesach fell and how many parshas you still have left. So, tonight we counted 23 in the Omer. Next Shabbos is going to be... No, tonight was 24 in the Omer, I'm sorry. Next Shabbos... Tonight was 23, right. Tonight was 23 in the Omer. Next Shabbos is going to be... Motzei Shabbos is going to be Lag BaOmer. The following week is Nim. And then... Lag BaOmer and Nim. And then you have... you're going to have Shavuos 2 weeks after that. So I guess it'll be... No, the following week will be Bechukosai, right. So that'll... Okay. So, our parsha, Parshas Behar, begins with a unique term that God gave this mitzvah at Mount Sinai. And the question is, why is that mentioned here? Hashem tells us when we come to the land of Israel, we'll work the land for 6 years. And in the seventh year, we let the land rest. We have different prohibitions. And then we have a commandment to count seven cycles of 7 years. And when we hit the 50th year, we blow a horn, otherwise known as a yovel. Yovel is a type of trumpet, a type of ram's horn. And that year, the land all goes back to its original owner. And on that year, we have to treat it like Shemitah as well. The Torah says, during that year of Yovel, so everyone gets their land back. And it's like a reset button. Every person who sold land gets it back. You'll ask yourself, what will I live off of all these years? All these years when I'm not working? So the Torah says, I will bless the crops and you'll have what to eat. The Torah then gives us a mitzvah we're holding by Revi. Again, we're doing the quick overview of the parsha and then we'll review it with more details. That if a person has to sell his land, there's a special mitzvah that a relative should buy back the land. If a person doesn't have a relative, then he himself has a right to buy back the land. If he doesn't buy it back by Yovel, he gets it back. We're up to Chamishi. There's the mitzvah of Batei Arei Choma, that a house within a walled city, the sale, you have 1 year to buy back the land, and if you don't buy it back at the end of the year, so then the land goes over permanently. A house within a walled city does not return at the Yovel year, only the lands outside the cities. The only exception are the Levites. The Levites don't have huge portions in the land because they were supposed to be the teachers, so they weren't given lands in order to work the land. They were just given homes. So if they ever sell their home, they could always redeem it. The Torah tells us that we have a mitzvah to support our fellow man if he's having trouble financially, not to take interest from him, but rather to give him an interest-free loan. The Torah tells us that if we purchase a fellow man, if someone is so poor that he has to sell himself as a servant, so we have to treat him like hired help. We don't treat him like a slave. We treat him like hired help. And in Yovel, he goes out. The Torah says they're my servants. And we have a special prohibition not to work them extra hard. Not to work them avodas parech, which we will define in a few minutes. Not to work them backbreaking labor. The Torah permits us to buy servants from the non-Jews around us. And those remain in our ownership. They do not go out in Yovel. And that brings us to Shvi. What happens if a Jew ends up being sold outside as to a non-Jew? So we have a special mitzvah to redeem him, because if you leave him there, how is he going to keep Shabbos and Kashrus? His master isn't going to let him do that. So you have a mitzvah to redeem him. And then the Torah says, that the Torah concludes the parsha with the prohibition of making idols or leaving idols around the land, and the mitzvah to keep Shabbos. So now let's review the parsha. You get up in the morning and you realize you're 5 minutes late. So we all know what those mornings look like, and we all know that we have more of those mornings than other types of mornings. You scramble to put on your shoes. You ask yourself whether you'll forgo brushing your teeth, whether you're going to grab a sandwich on your way out. How are you going to make it to Minyan? Are you going to be late? Are you going to be early? Are you going to be on time? Are you going to catch the bus? Are you not going to catch the bus? Finally, you hop on the bus. You start figuring, what did I miss? What didn't I miss? What emails do I have to catch up on? You sit down and you start replying to emails, writing to your wife, you're sorry you left the milk out. Maybe she could put it back in the fridge. You get to work. You see there are deadlines, you start working, you finish work, you come back home, you ask yourself, how are you going to finish all the other stuff? You come home, your son has homework, he's waiting for you to do it with him, your wife has things she needs your help with, and by the time you hit the sack, you haven't had a minute to breathe. And tomorrow morning is much more of the same. And throughout our history, life was always hectic. Today it's probably more hectic than it ever was before, but life is hectic. And one of the things that happens when people are busy is that they lose focus. On Sunday, we had our class on the Jewish home, and we began the class with the question, where do you want to see yourself in 20 years, in 10 years, in 5 years, and in 6 months? And all too often, people don't ask themselves that question. And even if a person has a few minutes to breathe and think, and we all have those minutes, every person goes to the restroom, every person has times that he's standing in line, every person has times that he's waiting for a bus or stuck in a traffic jam. We all have those minutes when we could theoretically think, but our minds aren't at ease in order to think. There's a reason why people who are hospitalized suddenly think about life. There's a reason why people who are in prison can have all kinds of deep thoughts about life. The average person, when he has those few moments, they're not peaceful moments. They're moments of pressure. There are moments where he's asking himself, is the bus going to be on time? Am I going to get out of this traffic jam on time? And we have a lot of things to think about. So the Torah gave us a gift. The Torah told us to take a whole year off. And that year is called Shabbat LaHashem. It's a year of Sabbath dedicated to Hashem. So there are technical laws, which we will discuss. Laws about how you keep Shemitah. But the idea behind it is LaHashem. Get close to Hashem. And one of the major impediments to getting close to Hashem is that we don't stop to think about life. It used to be, I don't know if this is still the case, but it used to be that in Chicago, when you came to pass the bar, after you finished all the exams, they take you to a room, give you a piece of paper, sit you down and say, now you have 5 minutes to fill out the answer to that question. And then the lawyer who just finished the bar, he has one more question, would sit down and look at the paper, and the paper would say, what do you want to accomplish in life? And he has 5 minutes to fill out that paper. And Rabbi Wein says that when he gave back the paper, filled in as much as he could in 5 minutes, he's writing and writing and writing, and then they say, time's up. The woman looks at him and says, that's pretty impressive. Most people give it back blank. What do you want to accomplish in life? I've been thinking about getting my bar exam. I've been thinking I want to be a lawyer, but now what? So the Torah gives us a gift. Once in 7 years, you stop. There's no mitzvah clearly that says, go to Beis Medrash and learn. There's no mitzvah clearly that says, go daven better. But the assumption is that even the most basic worker in the field, when he can't work and he's living off the fat of the land this year, well, he's going to stop and think. And that thought is going to take him somewhere. The Jewish people are compared to a pigeon. Why are we compared to a pigeon? So there are many reasons why we're compared to a pigeon. One reason is that other birds fight with their wings and the pigeon fights with its mouth. So to the Jewish people, other nations fight with their hands, we fight with our mouth. We pray, our strength is in our mouth. Our strength isn't in our hands. Another reason is that other birds keep squirming when it comes time to slaughter them, and then the pigeon extends its neck. And the Jewish people, whenever they had to give up their lives for the sanctity of God's name, when they had to, they were like the pigeon. They were ready to do it. But one reason that's quoted is that the pigeon has a unique sense of how to get back home. You have homing pigeons that are exceptionally good at that, but every pigeon, pigeons know how to find their way back to their nest. They can fly everywhere and find their way back. The pigeons are stronger in that point than other birds. And so do the Jewish people. Wherever they are, as lost as they've become, somehow they find their way back. And so when you give a farmer, you give him a year off, the assumption is it'll take him a week, it'll take him 2 weeks, but at some point he's going to come back. And he's going to leave that year being a better person because he will have thought about life and hopefully advanced. Now this is a mitzvah that's very, very difficult to keep. Go put your business on hold for 1 year and see what happens with it. People have a hard time shutting their business for Shabbos, for Pesach, for Yom Kippur, a whole year. My competitors, look at what they'll do to me. The Torah says, do it, and I'll take care of you. And then the other 6 years will be so productive that they'll give you enough bounty to last that seventh year. And we've seen that here in Israel. Every Shemitah year we have stories. Every year. There are stories dating back to before the state was established. Those farms that kept Shemitah have been repeatedly successful. More successful than the other ones. And this goes back to last Shemitah when there was a freeze that destroyed all the bananas. All the bananas in the country were destroyed aside from the farm that kept Shemitah. There are many stories. Every year there are stories that are recorded and documented. And if you guys just go online, you could look at it. You could look at old newspapers because it's also been recorded. You could ask Rav Listman. He's lived through more Shemitahs in this country than I have. And he'll be able to quote you from each year. Each time there's a new story that takes us by surprise. This is a fantastic mitzvah. Usually the Torah tells us work within the system. Here the Torah says it's Shabbos. I want the land to rest. And there's a deep concept here. When we speak about the land of Israel, so then we're not just talking about Uganda, Mozambique, some piece of property. If you note, we will possibly read Megillas Eicha on Tisha B'Av this year. So far, that's where we're headed. Maybe we'll turn course and we won't have to read Eicha this year. But so far, it looks like we're going to read Eicha this year. Megillas Eicha is all about the land. Who is the widow described in Megillas Eicha? Eicha yasheva vadad ha'ir rabat yam. That city. We're lamenting the city. Throughout the prophets, the land of Israel is personified. And there are many levels of understanding to that personification. The verse even says that the land itself gains atonement for the Jewish people. The land speaks on our behalf. And here the land is also given a rest, just like we are. Shabbos for the land. Yeah, Yohanan.
Would it be viewed as a lack of bitachon in Rosh Hashanah if you would be a farmer and would work aside from it? Just like
open a business? Do something else?
Open business, like helping out a friend, name it, like any other. Would it be viewed?
You could do that. No, you could do that. The rabbis made all kinds of institutions to help the farmers, which we'll discuss as we go through the parsha. So the Jewish people are given the mitzvah of Shemitah. And Moshe tells them this mitzvah over here because we're about to enter the land of Israel. Or at least that's what Moshe thinks. We're about to ruin everything, but we're about to enter the land of Israel. So he concluded the laws of the sacrifices. We're finishing off the book of Vayikra. And the last thing he's going to tell us is the secret to staying in the land of Israel. What's the secret to staying a Jew? Shabbos. If there's one thing that holds the Jewish family together, and if there's one thing that children connect to, it's the Shabbos, the time that the family can be together. What's the thing that holds the land of Israel in our possession? The Torah says Shemitah. Shemitah is the one thing that the Torah says, you transgress it, I'll kick you out of the land. You keep it, then that's the formula to staying in the land of Israel. So, as we're about to enter the land of Israel, Moshe reviews the details of this mitzvah, which we've had since Sinai. This mitzvah was given in detail at Sinai, but now's the time to go into it. So Moshe Rabbeinu tells us, you enter the land of Israel, you ensure that it rests. What does it mean, ensure that it rests? Just like Shabbos, you can't have a non-Jew do work for you on Shabbos, right? He's not commanded to rest, but you're commanded. You rest, your servants rest, your animals rest, and don't go asking a non-Jew to do work for you on Shabbos. Same thing with Shemitah. You can't just tell a non-Jew, go work my field for me on Shabbos. You do the harvesting, it's okay. We are prohibited from planting, we're prohibited from harvesting, and we're prohibited from doing things that will support the growth of crops on Shemitah. We have Aloch al Moshe Misinai, that the months prior to Shemitah are also prohibited. You're not allowed to plant something towards the end of the sixth year so that it will grow on the seventh year. If things grow, so they grow. But you can't go planting beforehand so that they grow. Now, different crops have different seasons that they ripen. So that means that the grapes will only ripen the following year. The grapes that grow in Shemitah will only produce wine the year after Shemitah. And that's how Shemitah works. Vegetables begin Sukkot time, because vegetables, they start growing right away. So you can't plant new vegetables, but all the old vegetables that have already ripened almost to the point of picking. So for about 2 weeks, 3 weeks after Shemitah comes in, you could still get vegetables from last year that were planted last year and that reached the point of picking. Come Sukkot time, after Sukkot, you don't have any more vegetables in the market. You still have apples, you still have oranges, you still have wine, you still have grape juice. Fine. You advance to the winter season. Now what? So you get all the old oranges they put in the fridge. You get all frozen oranges and apples that were frozen. You come towards the end of the Shemitah year. Now you're running out of crops. What are you going to eat? This has been a big problem historically. What used to happen, technically, you were supposed to go into the field and take what you want. The owner is not allowed to put up gates. The field's supposed to be open. And everyone could go in and pick what they want. What happened realistically was that people didn't want to do that. Or people would come and hoard, or people would come and take all their fruits and bring them home. So the courts instituted something called Otzar Bezdin. The courts themselves would come in and take all the crops and put it in the court-owned storage house. And then the court would give out every day, according to your family, you'd get a rationed amount. And this was the way the courts ensured during the time of the Mishnah, during the time of the Temple, this was the way the courts ensured that they kept Shemitah. When the Jews came back to Israel about 800 years ago, the farmers had a problem. What are they going to do? How are they going to stay alive if they keep Shemitah? So the rabbis then came up with a concept, why don't you sell the land to a non-Jew? Now this runs into many problems because there's a prohibition selling land of Israel to a non-Jew. Land of Israel is supposed to be owned by Jews. But after many, many calculations and realizing that it was that or bust, if they didn't do it, the Jews are going to have to leave. They're going to have to leave their crops. They're going to have to leave Israel altogether, and then it'll all be owned by non-Jews on a permanent basis. So calculating many different angles of halacha, the rabbis came up with a way that they permitted to do heter mechira, what's called the permission to sell the land to non-Jews. Now, this is a very complicated thing, and this is something which lechatchila we don't do and no one wants to do. About 100-something years ago, so the farmers were faced with the same crisis. Again, they were faced with the question, what are we supposed to do? We're not going to last here. So the first thing they did was they started the Shemitah Fund, where Jews all over Europe would donate money and they'd send it to the farmers, and this was what the farmers could live off of during that year of Shemitah, but it wasn't enough. So many rabbis got together and, again, initiated the Heter Mechira, which wasn't their invention. And the rabbis stipulated that lechatchila we shouldn't do this, and this is a big problem. There are many problems with doing this, but in this dire circumstance where lives are at risk and we don't have a choice, we have to permit it. Many rabbis opposed it. Many big rabbis opposed the heter mechira, and there's a question whether it even works. Maybe after you've sold this sale to the non-Jew, maybe the fruits still retain the holiness of Shemitah. At any rate, till today, every Shemitah, there's a big controversy, and the rabbinate still does the heter mechira. We also have Otzer Bezdin. Now, Otzer Bezdin, that's what we discussed. The courts take over a field, and then the courts, they don't sell it, but they do have every person chip in to cover the cost of taking care of that field. So even the Haredi courts do Otzer Bezdin. Rav Nissim Karelitz and all the Haredi, but they dinim from Bnei Brak to Yerushalayim, they all have an Otzer Bezdin. And basically what they do is they enter the field, they take over the field and ensure that Shemitah is kept in the field, and then they themselves they don't sell their produce usually in the stores, they sell the produce in people's homes, because you're not allowed to deal with Shemitah fruit like it was your own. So you're not allowed to sell it in a store as though it belongs to the store owner. Shemitah fruit is publicly owned. So what you could say is, we, the courts representing the people, we will give it out to people, but they have to cover our costs of collecting it and storing it and delivering it. So that's what Otzer Bezdin does. So if you come with me in 2 or 3 years when Shemitah comes back, so I buy my fruits and vegetables from Otzer Bezdin. What's the difficulty of buying Otzer Bezdin fruit? All that fruit is holy from Shemitah. And Shemitah fruit you have to eat. You're not allowed to throw it out. It has holiness. It's a special fruit. So people are scared of dealing with that. Because let's say I eat an apple. Did I really finish the apple? There's still some fruit left on the apple. I shouldn't really be throwing that out. That's holy fruit. So what do? I take a box and I put the fruit in the box and I say, I don't want to eat anymore. I'm not throwing it out, but I don't want to eat it anymore. Now it starts rotting in the box. After 3 days it's rotten. Okay, now it's rotten. I could throw it out, right? So what happens is you start having pach shmitah. You start having shmita bags, which are not the regular garbage, because I'm not allowed to destroy Shemitah fruit. So if I want to pour out all the ammonia or whatever I've been using to clean the house, I can't pour it out on the Shemitah fruit. I can't destroy the Shemitah fruit with my own hands. If I leave it on the side and I don't eat it and it rots on its own, that's not my problem. But that's why I cannot take the Shemitah fruit and put it in the regular garbage bin, because I'm going to put things in the garbage bin that will destroy the Shemitah fruit. So you have to have a separate garbage pail if you're going to buy Shemitah fruit, Otzer Bezdin fruit. That fruit is holy from Shemitah. You have a separate bin. Now, what happens when your fruit is 3 days old and pretty rotten? So then you could throw it out. But what happens when it's half rotten? If you're going to take a fresh fruit and put it in there, you're destroying that fruit because it's mixing with the rotten fruit. So you end up having 2 or 3 bags of Shemitah garbage. You understand this gets a little complicated. And with kids around the house, so having a Shemitah bin, a Pach Shemitah, can be even more complicated, but that's not an excuse. You know, initially I stayed away from it, but then I read Rabbi Yashiv writes, and everyone writes it, that what you're basically doing is you're causing the farmers, you're stifling the farmers. You're saying it's a little difficult for me, so it's their mitzvah, I'll be okay. So there's another calculation that comes into play. One calculation is, why not help the farmers out? We have a mitzvah to help them, and they're trying to keep Shemitah, and this is my way of keeping Shemitah. So it's a schus, and according to some, you're getting a mitzvah every time you eat fruit from that Shemitah was kept with. So why not? It's a little difficult, so you learn and you get used to it. This is living in the land of Israel. We have holy fruit here. There's a third calculation that also has a certain amount of weight, and that is that what are your alternatives? Let's say you're not going to buy Otzer Bezdin, because you don't want to deal with the holy fruit. And you're not going to buy Heter Mechira because you say, well, maybe you shouldn't be doing Heter Mechira altogether, and maybe Heter Mechira doesn't work altogether. So then what's your alternative? Foreign food. So foreign food is brought from one of two places. Either the Arabs in Gaza that are shooting at us, or way out from Holland and Europe. Well, those are your choices. So I don't think it's right that the Arabs say that they benefit on Shemitah, that their economy prospers like it doesn't any other year, and sometimes it funds them for years to come because so many people don't want to buy the Jewish-grown fruit on Shemitah. So I say, don't buy Otzer Bezdin, I can respect that. Don't buy Heter Mechira, I can respect that. Buy pasta. Live the year on pasta, tomato sauce, legumes. You could buy all kinds of beans. There's a lot. You could have full nourishment. You don't have to have tomatoes this year. What happened? So you won't eat tomatoes this year. I don't accept the claim, well, I don't have a choice. Why don't you have a choice? I did it for years. I did it more than one Shemitah. I didn't buy this, I didn't buy that, and I didn't buy the third, and there's plenty of food. You know, today you could buy hummus, you could buy, and more than that, we have in southern Israel, we have areas that were not dedicated as holy by Yahushua. There are areas in the south, which is really doesn't have the holiness of Shemitah. So you could also go to stores and buy from the south. And then you could buy fruits and vegetables from areas in the south that are not holy. And then you could eat that if you have to have your tomatoes and your cucumbers and whatever. But I don't see why everyone has to have tomatoes and cucumbers every day of the year. You know, you could live off of other things. And I'm not only saying to live off of milk products and meat. There's plenty of other stuff today that you could get that you don't run into this problem. But I don't think it's right that people fund governments that are dedicated to destroying us. And again, you could be left, you could be right, but you can't ignore the fact that there are people that are trying to kill us, and they're using the funds in that direction. But that's, okay, that's my understanding. Yeah.
What defines the borders of Israel from the land where you can't be? Like you're saying, southern Israel, you have places you can...
Right, so that deserves a longer class, maybe when we hit Parshas Maaseh, but the borders are discussed, maybe then we'll be able to go into it. Next we have the year of Yovel. Yovel literally means a type of horn. Yovel is a ram's horn, because Yovel, when Yovel would come, the slaves would go free on Yom Kippur. So come Rosh Hashanah of Yovel, you count seven series of seven till you hit 49. At the end of the 49th year comes Rosh Hashanah, the slaves are free. But they don't have to go home till Yom Kippur. They have 10 days to live off of the master. So the servants have 10 days where they party, where they just enjoy the owner's food, and they only go home on Yom Kippur. And come Yom Kippur, the Beis Din, the courts, would blow the shofar, and that was the declaration of the Jubilee year entering. And with that, all the servants would go home, and all the lands would go back to their original owner, and you'd have a full year of rest. Now, if you think about it, this is a tremendous system, a tremendous welfare system. A guy sees he's run out of money and everything he's tried has gone bad. What's he going to do now? So he could sell himself as a servant, and the owner has to take care of him. He has to give him good food. He has to give him lodgings. And he can't work him too hard. He's not allowed to give him avodas parech. What does it mean, avodas parech? He can't tell him, you keep digging till I tell you to stop. That's called backbreaking labor, avodas parech. He can't tell him, today I don't have any work for you, so go outside and dig me a pit 10 feet deep. The guy works for 10 hours, he finishes the pit, he says, now put all the dirt back. That's called avodas parech, backbreaking labor. The Torah prohibits working a servant backbreaking labor, and the idea is, we were all servants in Egypt. We can't do that to our fellow man. You can't destroy him. You need work done. You can have it done. Let's say there's only one pillow in the house. The servant gets it, not the master. Let's say the servant has a wife and children that he left home. The master has to feed them and take care of them all the years that he's a servant in his home. So being a servant was a type of welfare system. The guy gets money when he sells himself. He has to work, but he has a secure job. He doesn't have to stand online to get a job. He has a secure job. He has a master who's going to take care of all of his expenses. And at the end of it all, he goes free in the Jubilee year, and he gets back his lands. And now he could start fresh. And he has the money from his sale. And all this time, the master had to take care of his family. Yes?
This is referring to a Hebrew slave, right?
Correct.
So a non-Hebrew slave doesn't go free the Jubilee year?
Correct.
And can you work and they can do back-breaking labor?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the courts would do if they saw someone being cruel to his servants. They might beat him up for it. The Torah, I don't know of a place that the Torah addresses it. But that's where you need a court to keep an eye on what's going on.
The slave, the non-Hebrew slave, you use them for slave.
So let's start again. We have a concept that the Torah tells us that we may purchase a servant from the nations around us, and he remains in our possession. But what happens when we purchase him? We have 1 year in which we tell him, you have a choice to become a slave in a Jewish home or not. If you do become that, then you will have to circumcise, go to mikvah, and accept all the mitzvos like a servant. Now, what does that mean? You're going to have to perform all the mitzvos like a woman. And then you and your children and future generations, you're all what's called an Evet Kenani. Yes, we can work him, but you also have to realize that he has a certain level that he's already undergone. It's not a full-fledged gear. He's gone through a half gear to become an Evet Kenani. And the courts are also going to look after a person. If a person is going to be misbehaving, so that's where the courts have to step in and deal with the guy.
If he refuses to do the conversion?
Then he gets sold out. Then he won't remain in a Jewish home.
You cannot have over a year a non-Jewish slave wasn't permissible.
Correct. He has 1 year to think about it.
And then does he have all these amenities that the Hebrew slave has?
No. He does not. How would he have a Jewish mother? He's not allowed to marry a Jewish woman. He's allowed to marry a Shifcha Knanit. He's allowed to marry... the Torah will conclude with this mitzvah. The Torah says, do not afflict your fellow man. So the simple reading of it is, the Torah says, you know that in the Jubilee year, the sale gets undone. You get the land back. So you have to make the sale in a fair fashion. You have to make the sale calculating when you get the land back. Don't sell it as though it's for keeps, because you know it's not for keeps. But the Torah repeats this prohibition twice, and it says, don't afflict your fellow man. And from here, our sages learned that there's another level of affliction that's prohibited, and that is we are not allowed to say a word that will cause our fellow man pain. There's a biblical prohibition against saying anything that will hurt someone else. Any hurtful statement. Now that could be calling him a nickname that he doesn't like, that could be making a remark that hurts him. Anything that a person says that hurts his fellow man, that's this biblical prohibition. The Torah warns us, and the Torah gives a special prohibition, v'lo tonu ish et amito. We're prohibited from saying anything that might be hurtful to our fellow man. And just as with every other biblical commandment, we have to take great care here. And the Torah gives us a certain guideline. Our sages say that we have to be extra careful with this, with sensitive people. Meaning, every one of us is sensitive to our own weaknesses. So the Torah says, if you're in a room where someone has a certain lacking, don't mention that lacking. He's going to assume you're talking about him. Chazal gave us guidelines to the sensitivities that we're supposed to have. And all of these guidelines fall under this category of being careful. We know we're not allowed to say something that's slanderous. We know we're not allowed to call a person a name. Chazal said when it comes to a woman, you have to be even more careful because they feel things more deeply, and that's why they cry more easily, because they will feel something more deeply, and so the husband or anyone who's dealing with a woman has to take greater care. Chazal said the same thing about an orphan. Chazal said about all kinds of people, a widow, people who are disadvantaged in society. We have to realize that the pressures of life and their position in society causes them to be more sensitive, and so we have a special mitzvah to be more sensitive towards them. Shabbat shalom.